This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Many of the things we used to do by going to a specific location and waiting in line is done online. We shop online, bank online, make reservations online, order a pizza online, buy a movie and airline tickets online. So why do we still have to stand in a line to vote? For years, we've had electronic voting machines in many places, so it isn't like the voting process is still completely analog. But can it be brought into the 21st century? Would it be safe? Would it be secure? Would it lead to greater voter participation? Here to talk about that is Dr. Andrew Appel, the Eugene Higgins Professor of Computer Science at Princeton University, where his research has centered on software verification and computer security, among other things. In 2007, he purchased some used voting machines from Buncombe County and quickly set out to see just how secure they were. We will hear about that later in the program. Dr. Appel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In our studio is Dr. Martha Kropf, Interim Public Policy PhD Director and Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, where one of her areas of expertise is elections and election reform. She is also the author of two books on the topic, Institutions and the Right to Vote in America, and Helping America Vote, The Limits of Election Reform. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And for 18 years, Michael Dickerson has been director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. He's still in that job, and so we've invited him to be part of the panel today. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
Before we talk about modernization and digitization and computerization of the voting process, let's talk about tradition and the role tradition plays, if any, in this process. Election Day is a day when citizens come together as a group to vote for our elected representatives. Shouldn't that be accomplished, then, by some sort of communal process where we all take part in this old-fashioned way, where we can actually go to the polling places, and see some of the elected officials that we might be electing voting in the process themselves? Shouldn't that be the way we do it, as opposed to sitting in your jammies, eating bonbons, using your iPad to vote?
Well, okay, sure. I myself would love to be able to vote online, and it could still be a communal thing if we could vote in that method, but I think there's still lots of concerns about that. I have made the argument, though, that voting all together on Election Day makes it an event. Voting, to my mind, is not just political, but also social.
Yes.
And in the long term, when we're not voting together, I could visualize a situation where people don't feel the same social pressure to vote, and people don't sort of understand the expectation of voting. That doesn't mean that we can't change. What we would have to do, I think, and to my mind, is still invoke those social norms, invoke those social pressures, but do them in different ways.
Well, people on Facebook vote every day. They like people or unlike people. Is it the same process, or is this something different that we should elevate up above that ridiculous process?
Well, I don't think we should give up voting the way we do it now and just strictly go to an internet process. What I like about what we do now is I give you alternatives. If you can't make it on Election Day, you can vote early. Or if you can't make it on Election Day, I'm going to mail you a ballot out and I can take care of your voting that way. I don't want to restrict it just to that one day, that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, when we can all show up and stand in line and go vote.
What I love about voting myself, though, is that when I go to the polling place on Election Day, I see my neighbors. I see Chris Liebach, who is the Republican judge in my precinct, who just happens to have a daughter that was in my daughter's Girl Scout troop. And we chit-chat about our kids. I see Miss Birdie, who's long been the person who's run my polling place. Mm-hmm. In other words, it is that sort of social event. But if you can't make it to the polls on Election Day, there need to be other options.
And there are. We have early voting and things like that. But I want to talk about that, too, because other countries, we are told, seem to make it much easier for people to participate in the process. That includes weekend voting. And we always vote on Tuesday. Give me the date again. The first
Tuesday after the first Monday in November.
Is that constitutionally stipulated? Mm-hmm. Is that why we do it? How do other democratic countries handle voting? And is it actually easier in those countries?
Well, in Estonia and some other countries like that, they completely vote online. Several other countries have experimented with that. I understand that that is something that has made it a lot easier. But in this country, I think we have concerns with the legitimacy of an election held completely online. Hmm. Americans just may not be quite ready for that yet.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't Oregon, the state of Oregon, vote completely by mail?
Yes, Oregon and Washington and Colorado.
By mail. No voting booths on election day.
And certain precincts in California that are of a certain size.
What makes voting by mail any more secure than voting on the internet?
There are quite a few things, actually, that make voting by mail more secure.
Go ahead.
The post office does a pretty good job of delivering the mail from one place to another, and it's not that easy to hack the post office so envelopes go to the wrong place.
But you could steal the envelopes.
You can learn which voters returned their envelopes in a way that was received by the election officials. So if there was any widespread stealing of envelopes in the mail, mm-hmm. it would be detected. No such detection has happened. And then when the envelopes are opened up to be counted, it's done in the presence of witnesses from the parties who can see what's going on. So there are all sorts of safeguards built into voting by mail that we cannot replicate in an internet server. It's much easier to hack internet elections than it would be to hack vote by mail.
And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that, particularly in light of what's recently been reported about what has happened in Illinois and Arizona. How many ballots do you get by mail? How many people vote absentee by mail in Mecklenburg County, Michael?
In Mecklenburg County, I expect we'll receive about 30, 32,000 this year.
Is that a lot?
It's a lot more than I usually have on in any other election.
And is that because it's a presidential?
Strictly presidential. So we'll get about 32,000. I'll mail out about 35,000 and about a good percentage.
So to vote by mail, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. what do you have to do?
First off, in North Carolina, you're required to fill out a prescribed application that's available on websites. So you will send that in to me. I will complete that application, or you'll complete that application. I'll send you a ballot out. You'll vote that ballot in the presence of two other people. They'll witness it, or a notary, and she or he will witness it and sign it. You'll sign the ballot and send it back to me. Everything's complete. My board will then accept that ballot and count that ballot.
Is that how it's done in Oregon and Washington and wherever else you said they vote by mail? That people have to witness it or have it notarized?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Honestly, I don't know about that particular process.
So
certainly, I have occasionally voted absentee in New Jersey, and there's no need for a second witness or any kind of notary on my absentee ballot.
So for people who say that we have made it more difficult to vote through the recent voting law changes here, which are in suspension kind of because of the court ruling, could those people who have difficulty getting to the polls easily get an absentee ballot and mail it to the voting place?
Easily. Right. It's quite simple. Now, a couple of things. You'd have to have the application. And what North Carolina does is usually most of the campaigns will start sending out an application on the back of their flyer that says, all you need to do is fill this out, mail it to the Board of Elections, and they'll send you a ballot by mail. You don't even have to leave your house and vote. Mm. You can't get much more convenient than
and
that.
And what happens to the how far ahead of time do people who vote by mail have to do it?
Well, you can start anytime now. I mail ballots out next Friday, a week from this Friday.
So what happens to those ballots when they come back to you between now and Election Day in November?
I'm secured at our office. My board will meet and approve those ballots at their prescribed meetings, usually starting about 3 weeks before the election. Mm-hmm. And those ballots are counted on Election Day, first ballots I count.
Are there other states, other areas in North Carolina that vote differently than we do in Mecklenburg County, and in ways that might we might learn something from? Martha, do you know?
Well, we definitely use different equipment when we vote on Election Day. We use the DRE-style ATM.
What are all those numbers, all those letters mean? DRE is what?
Direct Recording Electronic.
Okay.
So basically you're voting on something that looks rather like an ATM machine, pressing your choices. An important thing to think about with those machines is that they're always, in North Carolina anyway, recording a paper record as you're going.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that too, because some of these voting machines, these electronic voting machines around the country, do not do that, surprisingly. Right. The Board of Elections surveyed county officials about the 2014 general election and found that most voters waited less than an hour during early voting on Election Day, and that in about two-thirds of those counties, they waited less than 30 minutes. But in 13 counties in North Carolina, voters experienced pretty long waits of more than an hour. What does the Board of Elections feel is a reasonable amount of time, particularly in a presidential election, for people to have to wait in line?
That's a good question. Simply because we're looking at what's convenient for you is the best amount of time you can wait. Now, that's a cop-out of an answer. What I look at is how quickly can I keep people moving through the process, not necessarily wait time. If it takes you 30 minutes to get through the stage and take your time voting, that's fine. I'm going to understand, too, that a lot of people are going to wait. Our wait times were relatively an hour or so for early voting in 12, I think it was, until you got to the last day. And then they're standing there for 2 and 3 hours on the last day.
Of early voting.
Of early voting, simply because that was it. That was it. And we're, you know, as people that like to procrastinate, I'm one of them. I'll make that time. I'll boil that time down to be that last day is when I have to be there. I still have Tuesday. But with early voting, I've given you an opportunity for 17 days to pick a time that might be good for you. Pick a time that you could afford to wait an hour. Takes you, you know, wait times are
something. I can't think of a single thing that I would wait for in my life other than to vote. I can't think
really?
Of a single. No, I wouldn't. If the wait time at a restaurant is 45 minutes, I'm going someplace else.
But so, it might be a great restaurant.
I don't care. I'm going someplace else.
But you don't go sit in the bar and wait?
No.
I like your thing.
No, because I think that's a scam to get you to spend more money.
Well, yeah.
But seriously, wait times, why should we have to wait that long? What's up with that?
Well, we're limited as to the number of sites, the number of voting panels, and the time it takes people to vote through a ballot. I've got on this ballot, I've got 34 questions that you're going to have a choice of making a decision on, 34 races that you're going to be able to. That takes some people a long time. Yeah. We're averaging that you're going to take at least 7 minutes to vote each ballot.
Well, I was going to ask, because we only have 30 seconds here, but when there are wait times, is it because there aren't enough machines for the people wanting to vote because people are taking a longer than anticipated amount of time to make their vote, or because the ballot is too long?
It's a little bit of both. Remember, you got a lot of machines. You're going to put your machines out, but that ballot is a long ballot, and we're restricted by the size of the location that we're voting
in. And I think Dr. Appel has some things to say about waiting lines. We'll have to wait for that to when we come back from the break. We're talking about voting, alternative methods of voting, and we'll get into internet voting and electronic voting machines, which will scare the living daylights out of you in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Kanane Group, building an enclave of single-family homes with classic American architecture at Cotswold Commons. More information at 704-752-9067 or kananegroup.com. Well, school just started, but high school juniors and seniors are already prepping for their next step, or they should be. College. Deciding on a school and beginning the application process can be daunting for students and for parents. College visits, test scores, essays, all part of the process, and each is important in its own way. So how about some advice on what to do and how to do it? We'll get that on this program from three different experts tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, results from primary challenges to Republican Senator John McCain, Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and others, plus new concerns about Russian hackers breaking into U.S. state voting systems.
Join the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about voting, voting alternatives, where voting might go in the future, the use of technology in voting, with Michael Dickerson, director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Dr. Martha Kropf is a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Andrew Appel is a professor of computer science at Princeton University. He joins us by phone, and I know you wanted to chime in, Dr. Appel, on waiting lines and waiting times to vote.
Well, yes. You know, a little more than half the counties in North Carolina use optical scan paper ballots. That means the voter fills in the bubbles next to the name of the candidate, and then when they're done filling out the ballot, they go over to the OpScan voting machine and feed the paper through. Now, Mr. Dickerson said that in the counties where you use touchscreen voting machines, it takes maybe 7 minutes or so for the voter to use that touchscreen to page through all the different races that they're going to vote on. And you only have so many touchscreen voting machines in the polling place, and therefore that can cause long lines. But in places where they have optical scan voting machines, then after you've signed in at the desk, they can hand you a paper ballot and a pen, and you can go over to one of the tables or voting booths and fill it out. And they only need one op scan machine that you bring it to at the end. So this means a lot more people can be voting at the same time when you use optical scan ballots, and that may reduce the wait times quite a bit.
That seems old-fashioned to me, but Michael, why don't we do it that way in Mecklenburg County?
Well, currently, like Dr. Appel was saying, we use the touch screen machine. Mm-hmm. I like it simply because I never run out of a ballot this way.
There's no paper involved.
But, well,
there is
that paper.
Little ticker tape in the bottom of the thing.
Exactly. There is a real-time audit log that tells me who and what and where you what somebody is voting for that I have to use to audit the process after the vote. The General Assembly has now said that my equipment will be outdated after 2018 election, and by September 1st of 2019, I will need to go to something of this optical scan type of equipment.
Why?
They've said they wanted something that produces a paper ballot, not a real-time audit log.
Are we one of the few states that demands that or will demand that going forward?
That's a good question.
Should we consider this a step backward, Dr. Appel, or a step forward?
I think it's definitely a step forward. That the kind of resistance to hacking you get by having the voter fill out that paper ballot that can be recounted without having to trust any computer to tell you what it says is a real advantage of the paper ballot.
But wait a minute. Well, you still have to scan that thing into a device.
You have to scan that thing into a device.
Why can't the device be hacked?
And it can be hacked.
Uh-huh.
But then you have the paper record.
Right. When you feed it into the device like that, it goes through the device into a ballot box. At the end of Election Day, all those paper ballots marked by the voters are sitting in a ballot box under the OpScan machine. And you can recount those paper ballots without having to trust any computer. And that's a real check in case the computer.
But what would make you recount the ballots? Why would there be a recount? I mean, if the race is tight, as it is in North Carolina in the presidential race, and one candidate of the or the other squeaks by, if everybody was using these optical scanning devices, who's to say that just maybe a handful of these devices around the state were programmed to vote? No matter what you vote, it's programmed to vote for the other candidate. Who's to say that didn't change the results? And who would then go back and look because it was close to begin with?
Well, here's how you do it. There are about 20 or 25 states that have a provision for a random sample audit or a spot check. And that is, you take a few of the ballot boxes and you recount those ballot boxes and check that they match exactly what the computer OpScan machine said. Now, if there's been enough OpScan machines hacked throughout the state to significantly alter the result of the election, then you'll catch a few of them. And if you catch even one, then that's a reason to expand the sample. Now, the point is, North Carolina is one of those states that has a random sample provision. So this is a important protection against the possibility of hacking of the voting machines.
Okay. Dr. Croft?
So I want to respectfully disagree somewhat with your long lines hypothesis on Election Day. With the optical scan machines, we're talking maybe only one place at the very end that people can feed their ballots in. And that is the error. That's a place where you get this error notification. Basically, the machine will beep or make some sort of noise or some sort of notification if there is a contest on the ballot you haven't filled in for. Let's say you don't want to vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. The machine will let the voter know at the end. And then the voter can choose to either let the ballot go into the box and say, I don't really want to vote for the president. Or the voter can say, oh, I'm going to go fix that. What I visualize is going to happen when we're using optical scan is that you're going to have all the people kind of stuck on that one machine, and the lines could potentially get longer. With the ATM-style voting machines that are used in some areas, the error correction is fairly seamless, or at least the notification. So that notification happens right when you're voting, and you get at the very end, you get right there, you get a notification that says you didn't cast a vote for presidency. And then you can go back and change it if you want to, or you can let the ballot go. And so that happens with all of the ATM style machines, and so I think that helps with the lines. So in a way, I think going back to optical scan is a step back. Another problem is that there is so much variation in the types of those optical scan ballots that it reintroduces a problem that we had with the 2000 election and we've continued to have, and that's that the design of the optical scan ballots varies tremendously. In this case, we need to think about graphic design and how people are able to use the ballot, because we test everything for its usability. We test our cars, we test supermarket lines, we test all sorts of different things for their usability. But we're not as while the 2000 election caused us to be more concerned because the punch card ballot clearly from the 2000 election wasn't an easy to see or navigate ballot, and it caused people to vote twice.
Two words, hanging chads.
Hanging chads, yes.
What's your feeling on this, Michael? I mean, we have these. I like the voting machines that we have. I think they're easy to use. They're intuitive. Anybody who's ever even glanced at a computer or a smartphone can use these with very little difficulty, and there is a paper trail in these machines. Is going back to optical scan, maybe it's a step forward. Is it a step forward in security, but a step backward in process, or how would you describe it?
Well, I respect what we're saying here. Is there a better way of doing this? Keep in mind the technology that we're using is not iPhone 2 technology or 6 technology or 7 technology.
No, you just said off the air in the break that right now to program the voting machines that we use, mm-hmm. the Board of Elections in Mecklenburg County uses IBM 286 computers.
You're old 286. It's
like 1980 technology, 85 technology. Is it Windows 95 based?
I think that's what it is. Yeah. Keep in mind, what are we trying to do? We're not. It's not having to break down some sample of something huge and big. We're voting. It's great, and I respect it, and we love what we do, but it's just voting. It's tallying a vote. How do you make a something that can tally the process?
Let me bring the security expert into this, Dr. Appel. I mean, when you talk about a 286, that's the speed of the processor, but only certain versions of Windows, old versions of Windows, will speak to that. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because most hackers today are
smarter.
Don't know what a 286 is.
I don't know what it is.
Maybe that's a good thing for security.
No.
So not your rappel
phone. As long as you don't connect those machines to the internet.
Thank you. Yeah, they won't connect to the internet.
So, well, that's probably true. So let me ask you. Let me ask you. Do the machines that you use to program the voting machines, do the voting machines themselves, or does the do the computers that you use to ultimately count the votes from the voting machines ever touch the internet?
By law, we're not allowed to.
Do they ever? Never. Do they ever touch one of those little thumb drive things that people can put in their pocket and bring in?
No, no. We put.
Do they ever touch an intranet?
No, no. None of that is allowed to, and that's stipulation by law. We're not allowed to hook these things
up
to the internet.
So, in this situation in Arizona and Illinois, where these machines were allegedly hacked.
That
was voter registration
right.
databases.
Right.
Yes.
And we don't know whether in Illinois or in Arizona they end up connecting, you know, their voting machines directly or indirectly to the internet. But the only hack we know of in Illinois and Arizona was the voter registration databases.
Correct.
Can I throw something out? I was trying to think in my head how that's a problem for us. And so if it did happen, which is a big if. What would they do? They'd hack into the database and take people off or put them on. And so what I think would ultimately happen would be that people just need to understand that they can check their voter registration. And they should check their voter registration. You can go in and look up where you're supposed to vote. And identify that. And I think in terms of adding people on, ultimately that becomes such a big operation. You'd have to find people. My argument with fraud that changes election results, it's such a big enterprise that somebody's going to figure it out. You can't have that many people that would change an election result without somebody talking. You just can't.
Well, unless they're in Russia.
Well, you'd have to find the people to actually vote if they were on the voter registration list. So you'd have to find that many people who, I guess, wanted to vote for someone that Russia liked, who were willing to do that in opposition of their country.
So in North Carolina, it's illegal to connect these machines ever to the internet. Is that the case in all 50 states?
So that might be a question for Andrew.
Andrew?
Because I think not. But I'm not certain.
I think it's certainly a best practice. I was involved in a court case in New Jersey almost 10 years ago, and in my forensic examination of their election administration computer, the very kind of computer that is not supposed to be connected to the internet, I discovered that on election day, the whatever election worker was using that computer in the county central office was surfing the internet to shopping sites. So, a lot of states have learned since 2008 that you don't do that, that you really shouldn't connect these machines to the internet. Whether they all follow these best practices is hard to tell.
Well, let's talk about the machines themselves, because you've done a lot of research, Dr. Appel, into these machines. And I'm going to start with a question from Michael first, and then come to you. And the question to Michael is, how do you know that the vote, that when we touch the touch screen and we vote for candidate A or B, that vote is absolutely being recorded the way we want it to be? How do you know that?
Two ways. First, I test everything. I make sure. Every single machine, every single ballot gets tested before it goes out of my office. Now, I've got 2,223 machines that I will send out in this election, and every one of those will be a logic and accuracy test, and I will also test every ballot for every precinct to make sure it reads the prescribed test script that a third party will create for me. And I will make sure that it gets.
And how do you know that every machine in every precinct is getting the same script?
I have a staff that actually two people are testing each one, and two people are and one person is signing off, and then we sign off back on, at our office on it too. So there are three checks that we go through just to make sure.
And then before we vote, the election representative comes in and puts that little block.
Right.
I don't know what you call that thing, but he puts a little block in the machine which resets it for the next person to vote.
Correct.
And he pulls it out before you vote. What's that thing doing, and is that thing, whatever it is, hackable?
It's a PEB. We call it a personal electronic ballot, and that actually programs the ballot for you. It pulls up your ballot. The machine is already programmed to have your ballot on there. What it does is activate the voting panel so that you can get your ballot.
Is that, Dr. Appel, is that thing, what's it called again?
PEB.
PEB. Is that hackable?
It might be. I think that's not necessarily the primary way I would hack that kind of voting machine.
Okay. Let's talk about this because you bought, in 2007, you bought some used voting machines from North Carolina's Buncombe County. That's up in Asheville. And you called these machines, and I quote here, untrustworthy paperless touchscreen machines. Why does the lack of paper make them untrustworthy? Simply because there's absolutely no way to check on the verify their accuracy?
Well, look, in a touchscreen voting machine, you have a computer. And when the voter touches someplace on the screen to indicate what candidate they want, the computer interprets what they meant and records in some way in the computer's memory. And then at the close of the polls, the program in the computer decides what to report in terms of the numbers in its memory. And whoever got to install that computer program in the computer gets to control what kinds of results are reported. If it's the legitimate software installed by the manufacturer, then it will accurately count the votes. If it's a fraudulent program that a hacker put in to steal an election, then it'll, you know, move some votes from one column to another and report more votes for one candidate than he got and less votes for another candidate.
And you'd never know.
And you'd never know.
And you say that the sale of these machines was good for North Carolina, but bad for New Jersey, Louisiana, and parts of Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Why? Because they bought them?
Well, look, I bought these machines because a group of public interest plaintiffs in New Jersey sued the state of New Jersey about the use of touchscreen voting machines that you can't trust to count the results of an election. And New Jersey is using those machines. They're called AVC Advantage. And I agreed to testify in that case as an expert witness. And in order to study these machines, I found that they were available for sale on the Internet. And the reason is they had been in use in some counties of North Carolina. In 2005 or so, North Carolina decided very rightly that you cannot trust these paperless touchscreen machines. They outlawed the use of those machines, and Buncombe County sold a whole bunch of them surplus on a website, sort of like eBay.
Yes, and you were able to buy these. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk about what you discovered, because evidently some of the security measures that were touted by the manufacturer were not, in fact, in place. And evidently, I was going to say a seven-year-old, but obviously it's an undergraduate at Princeton. Hardly a seven-year-old, was able to get in very quickly. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offering direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. Well, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, a look at results from primary challenges to Republican Senator John McCain, Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and others, and new concerns, possible Russian hackers breaking into U.S. voting systems, kind of a continuation, in a way, of what we're talking about. And if you'd like to join that conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or reach us through Twitter at charlottetalks. We're coming right back.
More than half of WFAE's funding comes from listeners like you. We hope you'll take this time to support the strong, independent news and storytelling you hear on WFAE with a contribution of any amount at 704-549-9000. That's 704-549-9000. Or online at WFAE.org. That's WFAE.org. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about voting and the security of our voting process and how to make it better and quicker and faster. And we'll get to voting on the Internet in a little while here. Michael Dickerson's here, Director of the Board of Elections here in Mecklenburg County. Dr. Martha Kropp, Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. And Dr. Andrew Appel joins us from Princeton University, where he's a professor of computer science. And he bought several old election machines that were sold by Buncombe County that were paperless electronic machines. And you set out to see how secure or insecure these machines were. To get to the motherboard of these machines, which is the guts, the brain of these voting machines, you had to get past a lock. And evidently the company that manufactures these machines said this is highly secure because once you get past the lock, there were other safeguards. Well, it took – you watched a Princeton University student pick that lock in 7 seconds. Then
well,
what?
Well, actually, he taught me how to pick the lock myself. I'm not much of a lock picker, but the lock on that machine is so weak that even I can pick it in about 10 or 12 seconds.
Wow. And then once you open the lock and you're exposed, you're not supposed to be able to necessarily see the motherboard, but you were able to get right to it, correct?
You have to unscrew 10 screws to take off the cover to the motherboard. It's not a big deal. You use a screwdriver.
And then I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's not that surprising that there should be a removable cover to the motherboard because sometimes those machines need maintenance. There's some AA batteries on the motherboard to maintain the memory, and those need to be replaced from time to time.
And on the motherboard are these ROM chips which you say you can reverse engineer and then prepare modified versions of the firmware on the chips, which can be used to alter votes in other still operating machines. Is it normal for voting machines to be sold to the highest bidder on an open market so that you could buy them, so that another state could buy them, so that somebody could reprogram the machines and infect the whole voting system? Is that normal?
Well, whether it's normal or not, you've got to think how many thousands of voting machines there are in this country. The idea that no voting machine will ever fall into the hands of a hacker, if that's your only protection, that's pretty weak protection. It's just not realistic.
And these aren't the only machines that you've been able to hack. And evidently, hacking isn't the only problem. You and fellow academic hackers, and we'll call them academic hackers because these are good guys who are hacking these machines to see how safe they are. That's not the only problem that you discovered. You say that there is no way to look at the computer code in these machines and verify that it will do what it says it does, right?
That's sort of true. The main problem is that even if you look at a computer program and have a reasonable confidence that it does what it's supposed to do, what you can't ever verify is that that program is installed in the machine today. You know, we can look at the program that comes from the manufacturer, and maybe it has some bugs and maybe it doesn't. But we can't know that that machine is still installed, you know, a year after the machine is sold or 10 years after the machine is sold. What I did was I pulled out the old computer program from that computer and installed a new one. Now, we all upgrade the software in our computers all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we get upgrades to our operating system. We install new apps. Installing new programs in a computer is what computers are for. And so the program that I installed recorded the votes accurately until about 10 minutes before the polls closed, and then it looked through its memory and shifted votes around. Now, this machine had some sort of electronic log of the votes cast, so it made sure to change the log, too. This is very straightforward on the particular touchscreen machine that I did it to. My colleague Ed Felton and some of his students did the same kind of hack to two other kinds of voting machines, touchscreen machines. Any kind of touchscreen voting machine, it's not hard to replace the computer program with one that cheats.
But let's be clear here. I think I'm right when I say this. The machines that you're talking about that you were able to manipulate so that the votes were changed inside the machine at some point are paperless touchscreen machines, correct?
That's right.
Okay. would the use of a paper trail with inside those machines, would that negate the ability to hack that machine or make it work in an illegal way, or would it simply print out a correction of a previous vote and that would solve the problem? In other words, if you have a paper trail,
what you're asking is, could I hack the voting machines you're using in Mecklenburg County?
Yes.
So, you know, those machines can be hacked too. But what would happen if you hack it? When you vote on those machines, there's the little touch screen, and to the left of it, it's for each selection you make, it's printing on paper
right. The
name of the candidate you selected.
Right.
And if the voter's paying attention, the voter would notice if the machine is printing a different thing on the paper than on the touch screen. We're not sure the voters are paying attention, but if.
I think we know that they're, for the most part, they're not. I mean, there's research on this, too. But what needs to happen is voters are educated that they can and should look at that, the paper record.
Is that easy to do, Michael?
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Sure. It's easy to look at the record. It's literally
down on the lower left.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So it is coming up. But he brings up a great point. If we're not looking at it, do we actually see whether or not it's counting what we have?
So let me explain the use
sure.
of these paper records. If the machine is cheating, let's say by reporting different results than what the voters really selected, then when you go back and audit those paper records, they'll add up different to what the machine mm-hmm. reported. And that's a very important safeguard. It's the main safeguard against hacking. It's not that the machines can't be hacked. It's that if they are hacked, then you have a good chance of detecting it, and you have that paper record to be able to get an accurate recount without having to trust that computer.
Why, if I can use an ATM at a grocery store to withdraw money and have that transaction accurately reflected at my bank, why, if I can deposit a check using my smartphone into the bank and have that accurately reflected, or use my computer to pay a bill accurately and have it reflected on all ends of the transaction, why can't we invent a voting machine that is 100% accurate?
Well, here's why. When you do that transaction at your bank or in the grocery store, you know, connected to your bank, you have an end-to-end record of each transaction. And if, you know, some transaction at a grocery store you're not familiar with shows up on your bank statement, then you can call the bank and they can trace that transaction. But in the U.S., we have the secret ballot. You're not, you know, your vote is private, and the secret ballot was instituted in this country at about 1890 or 1900 because there had been abuses. People were coerced to vote a certain way or they'd lose their job, or people were bribed in money or liquor to vote a certain way. So the secret ballot is a very important protection we have in this country against coercion and vote buying. But it means that you must not be able to trace the individual vote all the way from the voter to the totals. And it's that requirement of the secret ballot that makes it difficult or impossible to have a really trustworthy, entirely electronic process. If you were doing your banking and the bank told you, well, we can't trace each transaction to your account, but we can tell you the total of what you have right now, you wouldn't really trust them.
No. But there is something called crypto voting. I don't understand it. I read it three times yesterday, and it has to do with encrypting the vote and in such a way that it cannot be hacked, and it's absolutely accurate, but no one can understand it, so no one trusts it.
Well,
so we have I'm actually glad to have you here, because I'm curious to know what you think about the end-to-end voting machine experiments that there have been and have been used in an exceedingly limited way in some places like Tacoma Park, Maryland, where they have a system, and I'm not a computer scientist, but they have a system wherein you can go back later and use a code to check your ballot. And through, I guess, some sort of crazy way, You can let someone know if someone is trying to buy your vote at post vote. But you can, if you check a certain thing, and again, this sounds pretty crazy, but if you check your ballot a certain way to prove to somebody that you voted a certain way, they know that somebody cheated.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about those systems, so I'm curious to know.
People are, you know, computer scientists, as a research question, as a fundamental research question, are trying to see, can they design some sort of internet voting system where you don't have to trust whoever installed the computer in the server that's supposedly adding up the votes, right? This is the basic problem with internet voting or, you know, completely electronic voting. Somebody got to install that program, and you have to wonder whether it's really counting up the votes or not. Mm-hmm. And with internet voting, there's not only the problem of the server. Somebody could hack your own desktop computer or your iPhone so that the ballot you think you sent in is not the one that shows, you know, that's actually been sent in.
You've testified before a number of governing bodies and a number of trials as well, and much of what you've said, I'm told, has fallen on deaf ears. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's not as bad as you think. It's pretty bad in New Jersey. We're still using these completely untrustworthy touchscreen voting machines of the kind that North Carolina threw out more than 10 years ago. The good news is that about 40 of the states in the U.S. have entirely moved away from paperless touchscreen voting machines for the same reason that North Carolina did. You can't trust them. And no new states are moving to these paperless touchscreen machines. So, by and large, the states have gotten the message that this technology is not to be trusted, and most states are moving to paper ballots marked by the voters that can be counted by machine, but can be recounted by hand.
Politico reports that the Princeton group of cyber academics has proven that the machines that Americans use at the polls are less secure than the iPhones they use to navigate their way to the polls. would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, after listening to Dr. Appel with what they're using in New Jersey, I would definitely agree with him. I feel very comfortable and confident in what we do as far as the redundancy that we have put into place to make sure this is right, to make sure that we're counting. We do the random sampling after the election.
And given the law changes that we've witnessed here in North Carolina and elsewhere, and the gnashing of teeth that has been expressed by some over voter fraud and the need to stop voter fraud, why pass these laws if these machines that are being used in New Jersey and elsewhere in the country are completely hackable and could be open to a tremendous amount of voter fraud? Or voting fraud?
Yeah, I think you should distinguish between voter fraud and election fraud.
Okay.
Historically in this country, if you go back 50 years or 100 years or more, most election fraud is conducted by the insiders who have access to how the votes are added up. And, you know, of course, the vast majority of election officials now are, you know, have high integrity, are entirely honest. But we, the voters, should have ways to be able to trust the election without depending on any one person. And that's why all of the witnessing and audit provisions that Mr. Dickerson describes are in place. That, of course, we trust him, but we don't even have to trust him to see that the votes are added up correctly.
So what I'm hearing everybody around this table say is that the safest method of doing all of this is through these paper optical scan things, like those little tests we took in high school where you take your little pencil, your number two pencil, and fill in the circle, and then it's optically scanned into a machine which counts the votes. That's the safest way of doing things, and it's going back to the 1960s, actually, the way you're making it sound. So does that mean to all of us listening that internet voting will never happen?
Internet voting will never be safe. Whether it will happen is another question.
Wow. Could it happen? If we know it will never be safe, why would anybody adopt it?
Dr. Appel makes a great point. You're right. Why would you adopt that? He's exactly right. We're not going to take something that invites us to look at and question the result. Remember, you generally have two people running against each other in these elections. Mm-hmm. And that one person, if it's close enough, is always going to pull that out and say, I just really don't trust that.
Bill emails, are we more concerned than ever this year about keeping our voting processes safe and secure? Because no matter who wins the upcoming presidential election, the results will be contested.
Oh, sure. Well, this year is no different for us. We will make sure we do it the same we always do so that we are 100% correct and accurate in our process. Mm-hmm. We will document.
But North Carolina is reported to be right now the closest state in the country with regard to the presidential race. Is there going to be extra vigilance around the state at polling places and at boards of election to make sure that it is unimpeachable?
Yes. I think our executive director, Kim Strachan Raleigh, is always pushing us to be cautious, always sending out something to us to make sure we're doing this, this, and this. So I think she has a really good handle on this
process. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say the biggest thing that people need to realize, though, is elections aren't perfect. This is, and despite our very professional election administration in North Carolina, despite the observation of both parties, elections are never going to be perfect.
You get the last word. Dr. Martha Kropp, political science professor at UNC Charlotte, Michael Dickerson, director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections, and joining us by phone from Princeton University, Dr. Andrew Appel, a professor of computer science there. Thank you all for the hour. You got my vote.